I would always tell you to budget more money starting out. You know, my philosophy is, again, maybe a little bit different than most. I'd rather budget higher and then slash the number during due diligence than start low to get the deal and wind up having to double it afterward. So I'd always rather have extra cushion in there because that gives us a lot of protection.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in.
Hey, everybody. How's it going? And welcome back to the show. Today, I'm super stoked to announce our guest and introduce him, Charles Seaman. Charles, thanks so much for being on the show.
Suja, thank you very much for having me.
Well, really excited for the conversation today, everyone. Charles is a native of Brooklyn, New York. He currently resides in Charlotte, North Carolina, and serves as Senior Acquisition Manager and Asset Manager of Three Oaks Management LLC, in which he actively works to locate high-performing multifamily real estate deals throughout the Southeast region of the United States. He's responsible for performing all of the company's initial underwriting and analysis of these deals, which ultimately determines whether or not the deal will be a good fit for the company. He's also involved with contract negotiation and capital raising to make sure that the deals close, remaining involved after closing to manage the assets so that they perform in a manner that provides investors with exceptional returns. All very important skills when it comes to syndication. So great to have you here. Charles, why don't you start us off by taking us back in time and giving us some color as to how you were attracted to this space?
Absolutely. So unlike most people, my path probably started a little bit differently. As opposed to me seeking real estate out, I really fell into it. And I was fortunate when I was 20 years old that I jokingly say that I was young, dumb, and broke. And I said I was in desperate need of a real job at that point. So I was fortunate to wind up working for a guy who was very successful and, amongst other things, is a commercial real estate investor. And I spent 14 years working with him in Midtown Manhattan and working very closely with him and learning a lot from him. And I always knew that I wanted to be in real estate myself, but I also knew that I didn't have the budget to start with commercial real estate. So initially, you know, that was 2005 when I first started there. Fast forward about 9-10 years, you know, 2014, 2015, I started dabbling in single family and I started experimenting with wholesaling, but I quickly determined two things. One, I really don't like them as much. And two, I wasn't as good at them. I would need to develop some new skills to really be effective at them. And it's not to say that I couldn't have, but my preference was to use the skills that I already had. And ideally, if I could find a way into commercial real estate, to do that. So fast forward another year, 2016, I learned about syndication for the first time. And it instantly piqued my interest because I said, you know what? I can use the skills that I already have. I can be involved in commercial real estate and I can use other people's money. So this is kind of a win-win scenario. And that from there kind of spurred me on my journey to start learning more and more about it. And from the point of like mid-2017, you know, I've been active in the space. Initially, it was a very part-time basis, you know, 10, 15, 20 hours a week. And then from mid-2019, it's been largely a full-time basis. I do have a W-2 job still to produce consistent income, but I jokingly say that on the syndication side, I put a full-time effort in, but don't get a full-time income yet. Soon, though, it's coming. So it's like many other things in the money management space, it's all track record and building that reputation.
For sure. Well, it seems like you're well on your way. And tell us about, I know that one of your things that you're known for is underwriting, which is a subject that's near and dear to my heart because that's how I started out in this space. And I know you hold a weekly underwriting meetup. And let's talk about some of the things that are important in underwriting. Maybe just give us a brief overview of how you like to look at a deal when it comes across your desk.
Absolutely. The first rule that I would always tell people is it's better to lose a deal for being too conservative than to get a deal for being too aggressive. So if given the choice, lose the deal and be conservative. Otherwise, you may wind up in over your head. So most things that I would do, I would usually recommend being conservative. And sometimes one problem I probably have is that I'm too conservative with it. A lot of times I would tell people that there's groups that put things out there. And what will happen is you'll look at these things and the returns look great. But then when you look at how they got them, you say, boy, are we really going to be able to get 5% rent growth every year? And if you're in a great market that's showing exceptional growth, you might. But it's probably still not something I would underwrite because you may not. You could have a down year or two down years, and all of a sudden that throws your projections into a tailspin. So be conservative with your rent projections. You know, be realistic based on where the comps are, but also be conservative that you're not over-exaggerating them. Another thing I would tell anybody, and aside from purchase price, really the biggest mover in any deal is your terminal cap rate. So terminal cap rate can really make a big impact on your deal. If you swing it 100 basis points one way or the other, you could have a totally different return. 200 basis points, you're not even in the same stratosphere. So that's something I would tell people to be very cognizant of. And it's an interesting time that we're in because we're at a time where interest rates are very low and accordingly cap rates are also very compressed. So the challenge is, where will they be in, you know, 3, 4, 5 years? Unfortunately, none of us have a crystal ball, so we don't know. There is a good possibility they'll continue to stay low. Always make sure that your terminal cap rate is at least a little bit higher than your acquisition cap rate. So generally, you'll want to be at least 10 basis points higher for every year that you're in the deal. And that'll be a good rule. And sometimes you can be even a little more conservative. That's really a big factor. And then another thing I would say is CapEx. Yes, go for it.
Just really quick, you know, I think it's important for our beginner investors to just hear people talk about cap rate and what it is, since a little bit of, I just think it's a concept that people need to wrap their heads around. So what would your description or definition of cap rate be?
So I'll give you this. I'll give you my use of it. And it's probably a little bit different than what other people use it for. I think cap rate oftentimes is greatly overrated as a return metric. I think to me, what I really value it as is a metric of if I'm buying in the right place in the market. So if C assets in a given market are trading at a 5.5 cap and I'm paying a 4.5 cap, the question I'm asking is why? So if everything else is going at a 5.5 cap for a similar asset in that market, then I want to be buying right around the 5.5 cap. If I'm buying at a 6 cap, even better, but very unlikely in today's market. So to me, I use it as a gauge to get a good sense of where pricing is in the market and to see if the pricing that I'm looking at for that particular property is in line with the rest of the market. And at its core, what cap rate really is, it is your NOI divided by your purchase price. And it's going to be, if you were paying all cash for the property, which most of us aren't, it would be your return.
Okay, great. Thanks. I think it's just, you know, the more times people hear about these terms and in different ways from different people, then that's how they'll start understanding them. So thanks so much for going over that. So I have another follow-up question for you on something you mentioned about talking about rent growth. You mentioned that is 5% rent growth going to be achievable? Obviously, it depends on the market. Let's just say, for example, that there was a market where the rent growth the past year was like 9% and the year before that was 8%. Just as an example, what might you feel comfortable underwriting as far as rent growth? And, you know, and obviously there are other factors, but can you just talk to that question?
Sure. So for me personally, even in really hot markets, most times I would still not recommend using higher than 3%. And the reason I would tell you that is because eventually every market goes in cycles and there's going to be markets that are on the upswing. And eventually those markets are going to plateau and they may not necessarily go down, but they'll probably cool off and become stagnant. So all of a sudden, when you may get 9% and 8% at the beginning of that run, you may only get 2% later on because it's just not sustainable to keep going 8% and 9% every year. So 3% is really the max I would underwrite with, unless I'm looking at a really high level asset. So if I'm looking like at an A-class asset, then maybe I would go 4 or 5%, but at that point, you're dealing with a different demographic and a different type of product. So it's expected that you would get higher rent growth.
Okay. So just to recap what you've said so far, we've talked about rent growth and we've talked about the terminal cap rate. Are there any other points you want to mention, right? I mean, obviously, we could talk for hours about this, but anything else you want to mention at the moment about what to look for in underwriting?
So another thing that can really make a big difference is your CapEx budget. And that's something also to be cognizant of. Now, when you're first underwriting, all you're going to be doing is putting together a really high level number. And it probably won't be until you do your due diligence, which by that point you're in the contract most times, that you'll really be able to firm that number up and see the exact scope of work that's needed. But I would always tell you to budget more money starting out. You know, my philosophy is, again, maybe a little bit different than most. I'd rather budget higher and then slash the number during due diligence than start low to get the deal and wind up having to double it afterward. So I'd always rather have extra cushion in there because that gives us a lot of protection. Some of the deals we do, I'll look at 10 and 12% vacancy rates, and I do that just to make sure there's extra cushion. I said, you know, if I can make the deal work with that, then we should be able to easily exceed that even in a worst case scenario.
Awesome. Yeah, for sure. I think that's really a great rule of thumb to live by. What are some of the things that come up in your weekly underwriting session repeatedly that you kind of review with students? And maybe we've already touched on them, but what are you seeing people?
You know, in terms of the underwriting itself, I think probably a lot of the points that we touched on, what we also do is we open it up for discussion. And even though it usually starts with underwriting, it oftentimes goes into different areas of real estate and syndication. So we have a lot of questions about deal structure and how deals actually get done. A lot of people that attend the sessions are starting out. Some have done deals, but a lot haven't. And because of that, they're naturally curious because they're looking to learn and to figure out, okay, how do I go from where I am now to doing my first deal? Because that's always the starting point. You know, it's not going to make you rich, but it's going to put you on the scoreboard and you have to get to first base before you can get home.
For sure. Yeah. Well, I think it's a great service. Will you just go over what it is that you do in these sessions?
And yes, absolutely.
Give an overview of that.
Every Saturday on Zoom, I host a free underwriting session where we underwrite an actual multifamily deal. And sometimes the attendees submit different deals. Sometimes I pick deals of my own. And we actually walk through the deal. So we'll go through the financials, through the trailing 12. We'll look at the rent roll sometimes. And then we also go through the offering memorandum if they have one. And we look for different points. And I show people how I would normally underwrite a deal. And we make
Charles,
the sessions interactive. Yes.
Just ask you to just, for our folks who this is, you know, who haven't done this before, could you just define those terms like the T12, the rent roll?
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-cap.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Absolutely. So really high level. So underwriting itself is a fancy way of saying it, analyzing. But T12 or trailing 12. So whenever you hear T anything, T stands for trailing. And the number after is the number of months that is trailing. So a T12 is a trailing 12. It's the last 12 months of income and expenses. And as opposed to just having a profit and loss statement that has everything jumbled together, the benefit to a T12 is that the numbers start to tell you a story. So you can still get the total numbers when you look in your total column. But as you look through the individual months, you'll start seeing, okay, what's happening here? So all of a sudden, collections were really strong in months 1, 2, and 3. Then they dipped quite a bit in month 4 and month 5. And then they started coming back in month 6. So what happened here? And initially, you're probably not going to know the answer to that question. It's something you'll have to go back to the broker or back to the seller with and get a little more clarity. But it starts telling you the story. So the numbers aren't going to tell you the full story, but they'll give you a starting point, and then you can get words from the seller or from the broker to fill the rest of the story in. And a rent roll is a current accounting of the property. It usually gives you a list of all the tenants, the units that they occupy, the amount of rent they pay each month, and any additional fees that they charge, and also the start and end dates of their lease. So what I tell people is the trailing 12 or the trailing anything is the past. The rent roll is the present. So that's your current starting point where the property is today.
Okay, great. And you mentioned this before that you use the trailing 12 for expenses and you use the trailing 3 for income when you're
right
putting the numbers into your spreadsheet. Can you just speak to why you do that?
Yeah. So the reason we do that is because we find that most lenders typically do it that way. So on the deals that we do, most times we try to use Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loans. And typically they're going to underwrite it to a T3 annualized basis. So keep in mind, aside from just looking at the T3, you have to remember to annualize it. Otherwise your numbers will be really off.
For sure. Okay. So here's another question about underwriting. If you find yourself to be fairly conservative relative to other folks who are going for deals, then how are you winning deals? Because you are director of acquisitions, right? And so
yeah,
how do you win deals and be conservative?
So in the current market conditions, it's tough. That's probably putting it mildly. But at this point, we've done 3 deals. So I'm not going to say that we're the most experienced buyer in the room, but we're also not the brand new guy either. So more of our deals at this point come from relationships and track record. And obviously, we have to be in the right ballpark on price. We can't be totally off. But if we're somewhat competitive, like our deal that we have on the contract now, we have a 130-unit deal. And it was us and one other group that was competing for it. And the other group submitted a higher offer than us, probably $200,000 or $300,000 higher. And they were probably just as credible as we were, with the only caveat being that they were West Coast based. The deal was in North Carolina, where I am. And they didn't really know the broker, but we did. So the broker vouched for us. They put a good word in for us with the seller. And they said, even though these other guys look good, we don't know them. We can't vouch for them. They vouched for us. So the seller decided to go with us because they had good words put in from the broker and really relationships and track record. Most of the deals that we're finding at this point are in the 50 to 100 unit space. And I'll say 2 things with that. One is that it's a lot easier to get deals in that space than it is when you go north of 100 units because there's less competition and there's less real competition. A lot of times your people that you're going to be competing against are either brand new syndicators or they're local families with money. And most times a well-run syndication is probably a smoother operation than like a local guy with money. So it becomes easier to land deals in that space once you've done 1 or 2, because at that point you have more credibility than a lot of your competition. So that works really well. The biggest challenge with those deals is figuring out how to manage them. But if you can do that effectively, then oftentimes you can do very well in those deals as long as you're able to manage them, most times with the offsite management. Now, if you're looking at 100 units and up, it's going to be much more competitive. And even with aggressive underwriting, there's a lot of other factors that come into play. And some of those are non-refundable money on day one. So up until recently, that wasn't something we were willing to do. Now we are, but sparingly. But groups who put that up will win a lot of times because that really helps an offer. If 2 or 3 groups are competing and everything else is equal, but one of them is willing to put up non-refundable money immediately and the others aren't, then most times the seller is going to go with that guy because they feel that group is more motivated to get it done.
For sure. So circling back to the underwriting conservatively question, how do you get in the ballpark of price if you're underwriting 3% and they're underwriting 5% rent growth?
So what I would say is doing something like that, we probably wouldn't be in the same ballpark unless one of us made a mistake. There's really no way that somebody can be using 2 or 3% and somebody else using 5% and you're winding up with similar pricing. So on a deal like that, if it's something that is less than 100 units, I think as long as we weren't totally off, you know, so let's say if the hypothetically the pricing guidance is, you know, $5 million and we come in at 4.5, we're still in the right ballpark. You know, so what may happen is, you know, maybe you'll get somebody else that comes in at 4.8 or 4.9, but the broker doesn't really know them too well and that they can't vouch for their ability to close, then they might come back to us because we have a track record and say, listen, can you come up a little bit? Can you do 4.6? Can you do 4.7? What can you do to make it work? Mm-hmm. So really, there's a lot of back and forth negotiation. And at this point, being that we have a track record, it helps a lot with deals like that.
Okay. And just to continue to kind of dig into the details, since this is your wheelhouse, if you were going to try to come up by $100,000 or $200,000, from 4.5 to 4.6 or 7, then what kinds of, where might you be looking in your model to make that adjustment and be able to come up a little bit?
So the first thing I would look at is if I put that price in, what do my returns look like? And then the second thing I would look at is if they're not as favorable as I'd like them to be, I would say, is there anything I can do better on? So if I'm using a 10% vacancy, is it realistic that I could run this at 8? And I'd probably still show 10. I'd like to at least feel confident that I could run it at 8 and do better even if we don't show that. So I like to see where are the different spots that I could potentially tweak and what can we do better on. So as I start to look at that, if I feel confident that we can do it, then I'll usually up the offer price to be competitive with it.
Okay. And so then when you're presenting the deal to your investors, would you present just that those lower returns with the hope that it would go higher?
So usually, yes. I would say that in general, most of the deals we presented to investors have had lower returns than a lot of other groups, which is good and bad. It's good because we're being conservative, but it certainly does make it a lot tougher when you're selling something with a 16% return and other groups are showing 18 to 20. So, you know, a lot of times we do mention that in our presentations that we do have certain elements that are conservative in the underwriting. We believe we can do better. But some investors who are only looking at the bottom line, it does become a tougher sell with them.
Yeah, I'm in that same boat that sometimes our deals don't, even though I feel like they're very conservatively underwritten, showing like a 16% return, just it doesn't feel as good to somebody like in the moment to invest in than something that is showing an 18% return. And
right.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a cutting edge story. I mean, I think as we develop track records and show how that we're delivering, then they start to trust us generally and not look at the numbers so closely.
You know, you're 100% right. That becomes a totally different topic, but there are people that will literally follow you for 2, 3, 4 years and they want to make sure that you're legit, that you know what you're doing. And they want to see that you're actually turning a deal full cycle before they'll ever put a dollar with you. And some of these people won't even introduce themselves until they see you kind of sell the first deal. And then at that point, they come out of the woodwork and it's like, okay, well, I'm glad to know you were following me and I'm glad that we at least have some, you know, some kinship already. And then you can start building from there. But you're absolutely right. Track record goes a long way. And people like investing with operators who have protected their money and hopefully given them the return they promised.
For sure. And I mean, I think even to what you and I are saying is that not only meeting the projections, but potentially exceeding the projections, you know, so that they know that when we put out projections, we really mean that we expect those projections to be a floor rather than an average of where we expect the deal to land.
100%. My thought process is if it's good enough for Apple and Google, it's good enough for me. With many publicly traded companies, they do that with their earnings projections. Apple and Google just happened to be two that I thought of off the top of my head, but I said, okay, works for them. Who am I to second guess it?
What do they do that works for you?
So they oftentimes set low earnings estimates, so that way it's easy for them to exceed. And we do the same thing with our projections. I always jokingly say that I set a low bar, so it's easier for me to jump over.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, well, Charles, you've already shared so much with us, and I know there's a lot more knowledge that we'll have to have you back sometime soon to talk more about some deals that you're working on, maybe a case study of a deal that you've done recently. But for now, thank you so much. Would you please share with the listeners how they can get a hold of you and anything else you'd like to share?
Absolutely. So let me make a suggestion, Bill. We already talked about it. So for anybody who's interested in attending the Saturday underwriting sessions, you can text me or email me. Text me at 347-306-3278. Or email Charles at Three Oaks Management, the number 3OAKSMGMT.com, and tell me that you heard me on the Passive Income MBA podcast and that you'd like to join the sessions. We'll get you right in there.
Awesome. Well, I hope you all take advantage of that opportunity. It'll be a really great way for you to pretty quickly understand some of the basics of how we actually analyze these deals, which is such an important skill and will give you a lot of confidence if you haven't done it before and been kind of had your hand held through the process. So definitely recommend that you take advantage of Charles' amazing offer. Thank you so much, Charles, for being on the show. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com. for tons of free educational content to further your success.